to tell you, Rick. Okay, so if you want to go, and then I'll, if you want to start, then I'll switch over to speakerphone.
I guess my interest in the whole thing was triggered when I went overseas on study leave for the first time from the art school in 1981 to sort of find out what kind of technology they're using overseas. And there seemed to be sort of three streams of technology that were interesting. There was people doing stuff with video art and people doing stuff with photography. And there were a few people doing things with telecommunications, and I didn't really sort of get much information about that when I was traveling around. There was more going on with the video art and the holography in Europe and North America. But when I got back, I was contacted by a group of people at MIT who were using slow scan TV, and we set up an experimental exchange between artists at Paddington Town Hall and MIT, which was called TeleSky.
That was in 81?
Yeah. And I'm not sure, I can't remember a lot about that, but because it was fairly it was fairly experimental. But anyway, I think. I was trying to remember how I got involved with Bob Adrian in 1982. I think it might have been through Tom Klinkerstein anyway. In 81, I'm pretty sure he sort of contacted us, or he was traveling or something, and introduced us to the idea of using fax and portable sort of teletext machines that plug into a phone. And anyway, somehow we got involved in with Bob Adrian and started working on the World in 24 Hours, which is an event by Bob Adrian linking 14 groups of artists around the world to the Ars Electronica 82 Biennale in Austria. So that was really when things got a bit more organized, because Bob Adrian already had a bit of background, and Roy Ascott was sort of involved in that as well, I think. And it provided a way that we could get a bit more sort of geared up on the ground with the technology, I guess. I mean, when I first started using the computer system, the IP Sharp computer system that Bob and Roy Ascott were using, I had to go down to the company in the city here in Sydney and make myself an introduction, and then persuade them to sort of train me for about, you know, 2 or 3 weeks in how to use the system. And they weren't too amused by the whole thing, really. But I did manage to sort of figure out how it all worked and get hold of some equipment as well.
Okay.
Got sponsorship, you know, to get hold of. We managed to borrow some equipment anyway. So.
Eric, when did, with that sort of initial experiment, when did it start to filter into the classroom, do you think?
Well, it never really filtered into the classroom. You know, I mean, what used to happen is we'd sort of set up various events, and I'm just scrambling to sort of try to remember when Tom Klinkerstein came out, but I think I'm pretty sure he was out in 81, because I seem to remember, oh no, hang on, that's right, no, he's out in 83, because that's when we did the link up with fax and telephone, and you were probably involved in that in Perth.
Yeah.
There was a link up called Australia 2003 between art and media students in Perth, Adelaide, Newcastle and Sydney using fax and telephone. But I think certainly in 81, once we'd done the sort of slow scan thing, someone contacted me, and I can't think who it was, but it might have been Bob Adrian, and asked me to get involved in the IP Sharp computer system, which was really a forerunner of a sort of email type system. And that's when I went down and visited the company in Martin Place here and got my head around I mean, it was very good. It was a good system because there were only about 10 basic instructions that you needed to know, whereas I think at that time with email, you had to have a reasonable knowledge of the Unix programming system to use it. But IP Sharp had simplified it down so that business people could use it. IP Sharp was based in Toronto, which was where Bob Adrian sort of came from. And he knew the guy who was running the company. And they'd set up a private email system between about sort of 10 cities around the world, which just required required a knowledge of about 10 commands, and that was pretty easy to do, you know. So that's what we used for the Laplace of your text and the world in 24 hours.
So when we spoke a while ago, you were talking about something that that you believe that, like with Alexander Mackie and John Drews, that you were both teaching some kind of media art within the school there.
John Drews had sort of said he was keen on sound because he had a band, so he'd set up a sound studio, and the art school wanted someone who could teach the sort of visual side of media back in 1976. So I went along there and got fairly involved in the sound studio, and then managed to turn it into a kind of sound and light studio by setting up a program spotlight system. And we used the studio for the first experiments in multi-screen. We bought a multi-screen projection system with a set of projectors, six projectors, and we used that for a lot of the early stuff. There were basically the students who were sort of involved in music and performance and who had bands had a sort of feel for using projection, you know. And we set up some projects in galleries around Sydney. There was, I think, a sculpture centre on the Rocks was one of them. There was a little project we set up called White Wizard Dreaming. And I think it was Ian McIntosh, who actually lives in just around the corner from me here now in Avalon. But he was at the art school back in 1976, one of the first students. And he had a music background, but he could see the potential of the vision, you know, the multiple projections. So we set up quite a few experimental projection projects in various galleries. In Ros Oxley, actually, before it became Ros Oxley, was quite a good space. And we used that quite a lot as a sort of almost as an extension of teaching space. We just used to rock on down there with a bunch of students and take over the whole studio, you know. And I don't know whether you've been at Ros Oxley, but it's a pretty big place, you know.
So did you with the projects that you were doing, were there sort of written projects that you were giving the students that were relative to the kind of work that you wanted them doing, in other words, what they wanted to explore or the mediums that they wanted them to explore these ideas with?
Yeah, I guess so. You know, we normally work towards something, but there were always one or two leading students who really already had a few things going for them. I mean, I remember Ian McIntosh was sort of like one of the main movers, and he's become quite successful as an independent artist. And he's still got his own band. He would be about, I don't know, 50 or 55 now, you know. But one of the other students is into puppetry, and he sort of managed to weave some puppets into it as well. So we basically sort of tried to build on what the students already knew and show them how to do stuff with synchronized projected image and sound, and you know we sort of did a bit of kind of basic sort of sound composition and stuff like that. I had some good links with the Con because I was involved with a group called Watt at the Con, Martin Wesley Smith, and he was pretty keen on multi-screen projection as well. So we used to do projects there for the public and try and get our students involved, you know.
So how did it, you know, so from those sort of beginnings, how did it sort of evolve? I mean, you obviously went overseas in 81, then came back and telematics was starting to come in. You know, how did you creep that into the educational framework of the student work and so on?
I guess the thing is, at that time, well, I mean, first of all, in the first sort of 5 years, from 76 to 81, we were mainly using the multi-screen projection, and I got various groups involved, as say that Watt at the Conservatorium, but also a group from England called the John Bull Puncture Repair Kit, which was sort of partly related to the welfare state, a street performance group. So they came out and you know, set up projects for the students. But as I say, once I did the world trip in 81, I realized that there was more interesting stuff happening with high technology, like telecommunications, and I sort of wanted to move on a bit from the multi-screen projection thing, which was probably a bit more labor-intensive. and more difficult to do. And there were people coming through the art school then, like Jill Scott, who was pretty keen on video. And when we moved, hang on a moment, the other phone's ring. Let's just find out who it is. Sorry. Anyway, we moved the art school from the Rocks, from Alexander Mackey at the Rocks, up to Paddington, and we had the opportunity to sort of build some facilities. And I think Jill Scott was sort of around at the time, and she sort of insisted that we build a, you know, a full-on three-camera video studio with cyclorama, so we could do a lot of blue screen matte stuff. And also Peter Callis was around at the time as well, and they were also making those video synthesizers down the road. There were a couple of guys, I can't remember the name now, but they were building one of the first video synthesizers, and I'd sort of seen this type of thing in operation in America. So we managed to buy a video synthesizer, so we had quite a good little video studio, actually, and a lot of the stuff tended to revolve a bit around that, but I managed to, tack on a few other projects, like these telecommunications projects. It's hard to explain, I suppose. I mean, basically, we were pretty eclectic, and I think Jill Scott was the same. I mean, basically, if there was a big project hanging around, we try and persuade the students to do it. And Jill actually got into more trouble than I did, because she set up, decided that we needed a video festival, and she just got the students totally involved in sort of sticking stamps on envelopes and things like that. And administration wasn't too amused, but she said, well, you know, if they're going to have a video festival, they've got to learn how to sort of send out letters and things. It was like that when Stellar came through in '83, and he wanted to do a performance. We only had one large room, I think, at that time, because I can't remember what happened to the gym, but there was a room anyway which was big enough to sort of get an audience in, which we tended to use for events. And he wanted to do one of his body performances with robotics. We bought, John Drews had bought a Moog synthesizer, or an ARP synthesizer, rather. And we just set up this performance with Stellark and, invited everyone to it, really, and put it in the curriculum, I suppose, as part of the activities. So the students were press-ganged into it to help set it up and all that, you know.
That sounds great. So if I was to try and track some of this down, do you have any information of this? I mean, because I can always contact Jill and Peter.
Would have the information on the early development of the video side of it, and so would Peter as well, because he was sort of a lecturer at our place. And then Stellark, of course, there'd be some documentation about Stellark and the event that we did. Let's see if I've got a photograph of it somewhere. I sort of collected some of these things, but it's going back a long way. I've just got a couple of folios out here that I found downstairs in the box. Here we are, yeah. I've got photographs of Stellark in the in the room there. The sounds of Stellark's blood flowing, muscle firing, and pulse are fed into a synthesizer and a mixer to create an audio performance. It was called Amplified Hands, Stellark 1982, Event for Obsolete Body.
That sounds terrific. With the thing of coercing the students and actually starting to make it part of their projects, how did it grow from there with that? I mean, because how did you start to expand the interest that you had and the desire you had for the students?
Here, a note on a lecture that was held back in 1981, and I think it was probably, it was after the Telesky event, a couple of my students, who were sort of mature-age students, really, decided that the whole thing was very interesting, and they organized a lecture with Ian Howard and a guy called Brian Walsh, who was from Open Channel Melbourne, and they got a discussion going on telecommunication and the artist. So that mainly it was a review of the Telesky project, which wasn't actually very successful because the technology of the freeze frame TV over the phone was pretty bad. But you know, with things like that, it was people taking a sort of intellectual interest in what was going on, and Ian Howard certainly took an interest in it as well. He was always around and willing to sort of give a few, you know, say a few words about the projects and the significance of the projects. So we wove it into. I was actually teaching art history, I think, at the time, and we wove it into the sort of art history course, like the art and, you know, art and technology side to the art history course. So it's like a virus. We sort of spread it around as much as we could, you know.
Well,
going on overseas, we tried to kind of hook into it and, if possible, get the people out to Australia.
Yeah, that was, 'cause that would be one of the first sort of media art history courses.
Yeah, it probably was. Actually, just going back, I think, to, I think it was 1981, we got Douglas Davis out from New York in, I think, 1980, and he was a video artist, and he was pretty interesting, you know, so people like that sort of thing were used as a catalyst. And often, I mean, we didn't get a terribly good reaction from the faculty, which is probably something that Roy Ascott will tell you about as well. They just didn't know what the hell was going on, but the students were pretty enthusiastic on the average to these new sort of things, you know.
Yeah. So from 19, you know, sort of 81 when these things started to happen, through to 83 where Tom Klinkenstein came, and you were also doing the performance with Telesky. Was that the performance with Stellark? Was the Telesky one, or was that a different name? 81. Yeah.
That was a pretty big project. It took us quite a long time to plan that. And what we did is invited all of the students in my class, you know, which was called Electromedia or something, to do a little project that we could slot into the, I think we had a one-hour slot, you know, because the project, it wasn't 24 hours. The general idea was to go from one city to the next in time zones from Austria until we got to Sydney. And then we had 1 hour to use the fax and the computer system to communicate. So we sort of broke it down into about 5-minute projects and gave each of the students a 5-minute project. And some of them did really interesting things. You know, they put, we sort of projected the faxes up on a projector, and we one or two. I think Bob sent out some models that were to be sort of faxed and cut out and made into 3D models, you know. But it was one of the early applications of the fax, actually before Tom Klinkenstein came out, I think. It was quite a lot of work because we had to get the fax working properly, and then we had to also get the computer system working properly. So we had to get sort of two lines set up in the room and then try and set up some kind of presentation facilities. And, you know, we had people like sort of Mike Parr involved in that, and quite a few other people who you know, became independent artists but were students at the time.
So with this sort of hiatus around this period of time, did you feel that it started to spread to other institutions? Did you feel there was a
Not really. I mean, it was still pretty exotic. I'm just trying to remember whether we got involved with anybody else. There is documentation on the world in 24 hours, but I don't have a lot of it here. It's probably in that book on art telecommunications. Yeah. So there must have been other people in Australia involved, but I just can't remember who they were.
I've got a copy of that book. I'm just interested then how that then evolved into the sort of, because if we were to go to COPA now, we'd find a full media course.
I don't know. I've sort of lost contact with them, but it was always pretty hard getting this stuff into the mainstream. I mean, you know, as I say, people like Jill were always getting into trouble for, you know, over-employing the students. But I think, I'm sure Roy's done similar things, and that was probably one of the things that sort of got him kicked out of a few art schools around the world, you know.
Yeah.
You'd find a big event, or you'd find some big names and latch onto them and try and get the students involved. And nine times out of ten, most of the faculty weren't all that interested, but the students were generally pretty enthusiastic about it. So it's a question of whether you work to a curriculum, a standard curriculum model, or you sort of look outwards, you know, from Australia, which is always difficult. And you say, well, hey, you know, this is really exciting things happening in Japan. Why don't we try and become part of that? And usually you get a good response from, you know, Japan or Canada or wherever. But it's pretty hard when you're in Australia. It's probably even harder in Perth.
Did you then actually, through your career, did you actually then actually build some units that were focused, and did you get support with from the university to buy facilities or equipment to run some of these units?
Well, we never really sort of invested in the our telecommunication stuff much, because it was pretty exotic, I suppose. It was mainly a question of using whatever else was around. So, you know, like obviously video equipment and video projectors and fax machines and stuff like that. But, I mean, I didn't have control of the budget. I mean, certainly once I did have control of the budget, which was later on, in 86 I became sort of head of that department, we were able to try and buy better equipment. We generally try to get sponsorship. I mean, that was the basic way we operated. We try to get sponsorship for these things and get people to donate, you know, or lend us equipment and lend us spaces and facilities and computer time and whatever else.
So when would have been the first time that, when did sort of computers enter your classroom? Obviously you were doing things with the slow scan TVs and the phone and the fax.
I think we actually bought a bunch of Macintoshes around about 84. 85, and that was set up in a tiny little room. It was just room for about six students, there was a guy, Icarus Klepak, yeah, really wonderful name, but Icarus Klepak was sort of giving courses. I think he was actually one of the students, and then he became one of the sort of part-time lecturers, and we set up a bigger facility with ColorMax when they came out around about 86, I think. But people then went off in a different direction. Like, there was a lot of interest in using ColorMax computers to do photography and imaging. So that was like the main thing. And we weren't really allowed anywhere sort of near the computer lab, you know, because we sort of made too much of a mess. So it tended to sort of get devolved into, as an adjunct to photography, really. Photography moved from wet photography towards digital photography between about sort of 86 and 1990, I suppose.
And what happened to the sound in that context? Did the sound
kind of, I suppose, disappeared a bit? John Drews left, I think, around about 1982 or something, 81, 82, and He managed to set a good sound studio up in the new building, so we had basically a good recording studio, which was hardly ever used for recording, and quite a good control room. And then it wasn't until, I can't remember the names. It might have been Simon Penny. The guy who has been imitating that that right-wing politician from North Queensland. Can't remember her name, but there was a guy who was a bit of a performer, and he did a lot of kind of sound work on political speeches and things like that. So, but there was probably a gap of about 10 years, I'd say, between the time that we we moved to the new art school in about 81, and John Drews left, and then it wasn't until about 10 years later that younger people started coming through who knew about digital sound, and we got digital sound editing equipment. And that worked in, the sound studio was back-to-back with the video studio, so that worked in quite well for video as well. Like, you could edit sound digitally and add it to the video, you know.
So what do you think were the main drivers?
People are always the main drivers, you know. So it depends on who you've got on staff at the time. And then, you know, it depends how lucky you get with setting up facilities as well. But sometimes, you know, like in the case of John Drews, he set up a studio which was designed for live recording, then he left. And the studio was hardly ever used after that for live recording. And in fact, eventually it was used as a projection facility because there was a little window in it that we could project movies through, you know.
So if you were to sort of look at part of the time that we're talking about, if you were to sort of say that it could have evolved differently, is there any ideas that you have about, like, how you would have maybe structured it differently? Would you have kept it within an art school? Would you have moved it out? Would you have tried to link it more with science, or...?
It's a good question. I mean, I think a lot of the best philosophical ideas came from Roy Ascott, but we just weren't in the political situation to do much with that. In terms of linking it with science, it was probably a worse environment than, say, Sydney University, because we were eventually linked it in New South Wales, and that was relatively unproductive because both the institutions are pretty conservative, so there wasn't really much of a synthesis going on there, although there were other people who managed to get... there was a bit of a synthesis with CSIRO. Paula Dawson managed to persuade CSIRO to let her use holographic facilities and things like that. But I would say that there was an incredible amount of conservatism. I mean, there was a driving element behind the art school of conventional media and trying to sort of move things beyond that and trying to sort of, you almost need kind of project-based activity with fairly open studios, which was something that I think Roy Ascott always envisaged. I mean, when he set up the new art school in Wales, you know, he said, look, all I want really is a space for each student and a PowerPoint and a good sort of cafe in the middle of it all. And that's probably still a pretty good way of proceeding, you know. I don't think you can necessarily always get the right equipment at the time, because if you're doing something experimental, you're probably never able to actually buy the equipment when you need it. You might possibly be able to borrow it, or you might be able to hire it, but the chances of being able to buy it at the time are probably not so good. I mean, what you'll end up with is a situation where, for instance, we initially, I think it was actually back in 76 or 78, we bought a whole lot of video cameras, and they fairly quickly got trashed because there was no one to look after them, really, you know. The art school had sort of forgotten that video cameras actually need, you know, a sort of certain person to look after them. So about half of them immediately sort of got trashed and smashed and used in experimental performances and things like that, or pointed at the sun or something.
So do you think it's would you argue for a kind of rhizomatic or nomadic kind of curriculum that deals with media art that's maybe fluid?
Definitely, yeah. And I think you've got to take care of what's happening in the major centres overseas, or certainly the more interesting. I mean, it's interesting, like, looking back on the 70s and 80s, probably the places overseas that were more interesting were the smaller centres, like Austria, for instance, and Canada, places in Canada, and parts of America, but not necessarily New York. But if you can be in a position to look outwards, and also, I guess, if you can encourage the university or the college to support students traveling and exchanging. I mean, that was another thing that we should have been able to do a heck of a lot more than that. And when we joined the university, they had wonderful contacts, but again, the conservatism of the faculty was such that it wasn't all that easy to get things happening, you know. Sometimes we managed one or two informal exchanges, and I suppose now they're probably, you know, there's probably a lot more of that goes on. But I think that's an important part of it as well, to try and get exchanges of staff and students on a more regular basis. Because, I mean, this whole idea, for instance, 6 months study leave, do they still have that at your place?
Yeah, they do.
Well, one of the problems with that at our place was that it actually presented quite a big economic problem for lecturers, because just to sort of be able to fund a trip overseas and spend 6 months travelling around and stuff like that was a lot more expensive than any of the grants that you got. So it would have probably been better in retrospect if people could have gone overseas, you know, for a month at a time or something like that, and spent a bit less money, but got a better idea what was going on. Just travel around a bit.
Well, maybe we should wind up for a while, Eric, to give you a chance to have a bit of a break and think about it, and we could talk about where to from here, and I could stop recording so that we could just finish this one off.